it's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year?
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations? Forgotten. The history?
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
The Athletic.
Hello everybody and welcome once again to The View from the Lane. You know what it is, you know what we are, champions of Europe, multi-award-winning Tottenham Hotspur podcast from The Athletic. Joining me, Danny Kelly, are The Athletic's Jack Pitbrook and James Moore. And given that Spurs haven't played since the last podcast, we've got a ton of stuff to get through. We'll be answering one or two of your more pointed questions that you've asked. We'll be discussing that famous night in Amsterdam 5 years ago this week, and we'll discuss the Burnley game at home. Some great questions from you, the lovely listeners, this week. One from Sammy, who says, what are we getting from Ange's recent interviews, specifically the one he did with Optus Sport? This was a couple of days ago with Mark Schwarzer. He's a bright fella, Mark, but he has no side to him, so I was interested in the interview. What did you make of it, Jack?
Yeah, I thought it was really good. So this is an interview that you can find it on YouTube. It's about 12 minutes long. And Ange is reflecting, quite honestly, on the situation that Spurs are in at the moment. I think the bit that's got the most pickup online is where Mark Schwarzer asks him, you know, how are you finding this particular like difficult patch at the moment? Now Spurs have lost 4 in a row. And Ange says, this is the bit I love, mate. This is my purpose. And the point he's making is that he has to be more visible, more present now than almost any other time. And it's also the time where I've heard him discuss this in another podcast that he did a few years ago that I was listening to yesterday with Anthony Hudson. And I think the idea for Ange is that it's in these bad moments when he really feels the strength of his convictions the most, and he knows that his convictions will be tested, and you learn about people more, and he hopes that you can kind of grow more through this painful process. I know that, you know, he said words like this in some of the recent defeats, and people don't always like it because people would understandably rather Tottenham were just winning all the time. But it's an interesting insight and perspective, and you do get a sense from it that no matter how bad results have been recently, this is not going to lead to any kind of big compromise or U-turn in his approach and beliefs.
It's really one in the eye for all those people are saying it's a bit cult-like, isn't it? The idea that you will be tested and you must endure the tests.
The problem for fans like me is that it's impossible to work out whether this is a man of conviction who is going to use his experience and his talent, all the things that we know he's got, to actually turn this around and really believes what he's saying. Because if not, there's a part of me that sees Richie Sunak on the television saying it's all going well, while behind him, the country's in flames. And, you know, the problem is that everybody in the modern world has been to media training, psychological courses, and all the rest of it. And so one of the things you do is you continue to exude positivity in every situation as though that were in itself enough. And it's not. But I thought the interview myself, I thought he was looking Mark squarely in the face, which I thought was a great improvement, because whether you like it or not, the world we live in, optics matter, audionics matter, how you present yourself matters. It shouldn't, but it does. I thought it was away from the slightly, I suppose, what he would see as a bear pit, Jack, of a press conference where it's just one-on-one. There were connections there that made it a little bit more relaxed. And I was more relaxed as well because, again, you're right, it was using words that were a bit culty, but it didn't seem to be quite as defensive as it normally is when, frankly, Charlie riles him with his questions.
Can I just say here, I said this the other week, but there is an instrumental value to having a personality cult around a manager. Like, you need a cult if it's going to work. It's not going to work if the manager shows up and he's like a normal person. It's not, if a manager shows up and it's like, well, I've got some ideas, but I'm not sure about them, and maybe they'll work. But if you've got some ideas, let's hear them.
So Carlo Ancelotti is the outlier here, is he?
I think he's the exception that proves the rule.
I think he's also,
I mean, the way that he works, I think, is perfectly attuned to working with the best players in the world. But if you don't have the best players in the world, you really need to find that extra kind of 5% of belief. And you do that with kind of almost like insanely zealous conviction about the type of manager that you're trying to be. And you've got to be absolutely, totally committed to your own ideas, because that's the only way you're going to bring people with you. You cannot bring people with you if you're going to be diffident.
Do you do this in your own life, Jack?
No, not at all. I'm not. I'd be a terrible manager. I'm far too...
No. Would you be a good follower? Are you a good follower? When James says this is what we're going to do on The Athletic... Do you think, wow, that's the, I've been going with James for years. I'm asking you because, as I said before, and in response to what you said, my personality, possibly because I was forced to reject a very formal religious upbringing, is that I can't buy into anybody or anything, no matter how great it thinks it is, unquestioningly. I love things, unquestioningly, but you can't be following people's cults.
Yeah, I would say there's a difference
between... like having faith in something and following it completely unquestioningly. Like you can believe something will work. You can have belief in a system and also be aware that sometimes you're going to get setbacks and sometimes it's going to be difficult and sometimes it's going to work better than other times. But that, I guess there's a difference between losing faith kind of in the short term, like say when you tweak something aggy about a football team at half time during a match and get loads of abuse, and actually kind of having lost faith in like the longer term and say wanting a manager to get sacked.
Two completely different things. I do get where you're coming from, Jack. And, you know, footballers as a group like to give up their autonomy, give up their self-responsibility. You know, Roy Keane turning up at the airport didn't realise you had to have a passport to travel abroad. And so you give up some of your responsibility by following the leader. I get it. Ben asks... There is so much talk about lighthouse players taken from Pep's speech about Rodri. Arsenal have Rice, etc., says Ben. Do we have our lighthouse already, albeit one in choppy, thunderous waters? Also known as Romero. Incredible passer, tackler, interceptor, aggressive, can finish. James, what is a lighthouse player?
Well, I think I'm right in saying there's a quote from Rodri from a couple of years ago where he says, Guardiola tells me to be the coach on the field. He compares my position to that of a lighthouse. Don't move. Let everything revolve around you. So I guess my instinct is that Romero isn't going to be like that.
No.
Romero's not going to let everything revolve around him. He is going to go...
He's revolving.
He's kick the shit out of a lighthouse. He's the seagull that's going to take a huge dump down the side of a lighthouse, isn't he?
He is not one who you want... I mean, I love him, of course, and I also despise him when he does some mad things, but I love him. No, he's more of a kind of... helicopter, isn't it? That flies into the danger zones and attempts to the rescues, whether in attack or defence. He's not going to stand there being stoic. That's the last thing I expect of the great man.
If we take the question to mean could Romero play in midfield, though, which I suppose is really the essence of the question, we're about getting too confused. I still think no. I think you need. Do you need more? I'm sure you need positional discipline. To be able to play in that role. And I'm not really convinced that he has that. Like, for good and for bad. And we've seen some of the good of it recently. I would just worry that he would hair off too often after, you know, he'd get into an argument with, like, the opposition fullback at a set piece and then suddenly he'd have gone off after them in open play and they've left a massive... I mean, not that it'd be massively different to what we've got now.
You're not going to play a centre-half in midfield these days, are you, Jack? Unless you're going to do Manchester City and play them all, they're all centre-halves.
No, I wouldn't do that. But I do completely agree that Spurs need someone like this. I think we've been talking about this on the podcast for a while recently. I think it's the biggest issue in the team, even more so than lack of goals up front. They need someone who can who can play in that role, like a Rodri, and stop the opposition counter-attack. Bissouma, I don't think, can do it. Bentancur, I don't think it's his game either, really, and he's also not playing especially well. So I think we said last week, if whatever the Tottenham transfer budget is, I think this is what they should be focusing on. Who that is exactly, I don't know. Also, what I don't know is how did Ange's Celtic operate in this area? Did they have a kind of a Rodri-type player in that space? I'm not sure if they did or not.
They had McGregor and Forrest, just because the opposition was weaker. People just rotated the ball very efficiently.
But I think in the Premier League, you're going to get killed on the break, whoever you're playing.
Well, teams are literally designed to kill you on that specific move, aren't they? Absolutely right. Thank you, Ben. Right, Jack Socrates, who is, of course, that is a brilliant name, Jack. Well done. This is interesting. Favorite goal of the season? For some reason, I can't think of any. He says maybe Kulusevski against City, Son at Arsenal.
I've got a really bad memory for this sort of thing. This is why we need Charlie. Yeah. Madison at Villa Park, just because Saar puts that brilliant cross in from the right and then Madison runs full pelt to meet it. That stuck out in my head as being really good.
Yeah.
There's also a moment as well, wasn't it, in a significant game?
Yeah, it felt like a big moment.
Son away at Arsenal as well, I suppose, the second goal, the equaliser immediately after Arsenal had gone in front.
It doesn't have any great meaning, but in the... Van der Ven's shot against Nottingham Forest, because, you know, one occasionally likes to see a football hit like that. And I thought it was a brilliant, brilliant goal.
Can I wind on 4 minutes then and pick the Pedro Porro one from the same game?
Yeah.
It was a really, really nice finish. I think we said at the time, kind of overshadowed by the Van der Ven one. And I suspect possibly slightly more off the training ground. I know it wasn't quite in the traditions of the kind of Timo Werner, Brennan Johnson ball pulled across the seaside.
No, but it still requires the right-sided defender to be virtually on the penalty spot to take it. Yeah, of course.
Exactly right.
Porro versus Burnley in the FA Cup.
Long range, not interested.
Well, as we know, James doesn't like... Were you on the podcast, Jack?
I actually also don't really like long range thumps, because it's just a thump. But I actually can't really think of that many other good goals. I feel like my brain's not working this morning. So yeah, I'm going to say Porro's basic thump against Burnley was at least quite good.
Welcome back to The View from England. This is me, Danny Kelly. James Moore and Jack Pitbrook are also on the firm. It was, as we've been saying, 5 years yesterday since that famous night in Amsterdam. Spurs' win, the last moments, very unlikely. And Lucas Moura coming to the rescue. Where were you and what was your memory? Where were you, James?
Annoyingly, I was at home.
Yeah.
Having kind of tried to plot to get out to Amsterdam, I basically tried to blag tickets for however many weeks, I guess not that many, because it was quite a quick turnaround.
Yeah.
And been unable to get one. I just decided to watch at home and kind of endure it behind closed doors. And obviously, with the benefit of hindsight, I would have made more of an effort to go somewhere and watch it with other people.
Sure. This may be your time machine moment for later in the show.
Well, maybe. No, there'd be better things than that, let's face it.
Good.
It does kind of feel like a bit of a shame. I mean, obviously, I reflect on it with incredible fondness. And seeing it back, especially seeing that BT Sport video, there's like a kind of 7 minute video of Glenn Hoddle's reaction and stuff. That does make me quite emotional still. But yeah, I do kind of regret watching it at home with a bloke I live with at the time.
Ah.
There you go.
What about you, Jack? Where were you?
I was at the Johan Cruyff Arena in the press box. And I think it's... I still think the City game was better. The City second leg was the best game I've ever been to. But this was probably the most unlikely and amazing moment, I think. I remember at 2-0 thinking, this is completely done. Spurs are not going to score three goals. And then I had a piece written about, because obviously De Ligt scored the first goal for Ajax. And I was perfecting this piece about De Ligt is the next great player and he's going to, taking Ajax into the final and he's going to be the great player the next 10 years and so on. And then obviously Lucas scores twice straight after half time and you think, is this really sustainable, this Matthijs De Ligt piece? I kind of changed it to be Matthijs De Ligt was given the fright of his life by Tottenham, but he'll still be in the final.
By emerging superstar Lucas Moura.
And then I kind of... before the third goal, because I was sat next to my then colleague Jonathan Liu. This is when we were both working for the Independent.
Yeah.
And I remember talking to him before the third goal and thinking, whatever happens here, Ajax are going to get torn to pieces in the final by Liverpool, aren't they? Because in both legs, Ajax were kind of dead on their feet after about an hour. Like, they had nothing left physically. And, you know, there were a few times where Spurs were breaking through and they didn't score before the Lucas got, before Lucas's third, where you thought, this is just a bit too, they're just too open, they've got nothing left. But obviously, at the same time, Ajax were going down the other end and they hit the post, didn't they? And they, I think Lloris made a save.
Yeah.
And then when the goal, when the third goal went in, my first memory is, I've never seen play. It's not like the jubilance of the Spurs players that stuck with me. It's the devastation of the Ajax players. I've never seen a football team in my life of watching football that devastated by anything. Like, they were fully on the ground. They were all on the ground, heads in hands, not moving.
It's amazing.
And that was like, wow, this is something else. And I wrote my match report, and then after the game, I had to write a piece which we published on the Independent website the next morning, a kind of a follow-up piece. And I wanted to kind of, I was getting my head around how unlikely it was that Tottenham were in the final, because obviously anybody who watched Tottenham this season knew the team was clearly in decline. They'd been really quite bad in the league since Christmas. And I was writing this piece probably back at the hotel at, I don't know, let's say 2 a.m. or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote it in a bit of a rush, and I worded it badly, and the way I worded this, I described Tottenham as, quote, the worst team to be in a Champions League final since, I think it would have been since Monaco 2004, was probably how I phrased it. And what I should have said, really, in hindsight, is they were like the unlikeliest team to be in a final since 2004. And then, first thing the next morning, I flew back from Schiphol to City Airport. Landed at City, turned my phone on, and I saw like my Twitter, which is millions of Spurs fans being like, "How dare you? This is like the I can't believe you hate us so much. You're a bitter City fan, and you hate us because we're in the final and you're not, and you're just trying to piss on our parade. You bitter twat."
Two things on that. Sorry. One. Is it possible I tweeted you about that?
I don't know. Well, we can use Twitter advanced search to find out.
Oh, it's very easy.
And two, obviously, if it happened when you're working for me, I would have changed it. But
well. Yeah, I spoke to my bosses and got them to change the wording to say like unlikeliest team rather than worst. Like, I think it's probably true to say that Spurs were that Spurs team at that point was the worst team to be in a Champions League final. But at the time, I can totally see why it would go down badly with the fan base, because it's like the best night of their life. The last thing they want to see is some like laptop dickhead like me, like seemingly pissing on their fun.
I mean, look, I'd worked in London on the Monday because I remember going nuts about the company and all the rest of it. And I'd come home here to Ireland, and I was very glad that my missus was away in England doing something, because I like to, I mean, football in a stadium is the best thing. But then if I'm watching football, I don't like to watch with other people on the telly. I prefer to watch it on my own. And I was on my own, and the goals went in, and you just thought, this is very sad. It's not going to happen. After all that, what they did in Manchester, this is not going to happen. And then it did happen. And I think about it a lot. The two touches, with all the flamboyance of football, all the science that goes into it, Llorente's touch out of the air, it's something he's probably done a million times, but it could not have been more perfect. The ball rolled out of his control into the pathway of Dele Alli. Alli's pass doesn't go more than 11, 12 feet maximum, but it couldn't have been. That's the only place on earth that De Ligt could not have intercepted it. It goes to that spot. And then Lucas Moura, who nobody would call a razor-sharp finisher, but he was having a great night, puts it past, was it Onana? I think it was Onana, wasn't it? Into the net. The little tiny things that went right. So yesterday I put it up on Twitter. I realised that when the final whistle went, that not only was a tear running down my face, like it happens to me all the time, I'm very quick to tears, both of joy and pain, but I was sobbing. I was sobbing like a child. And I remember when I took my glasses off that the insides and the bit nearest your face were all wet. I don't know if the tears were coming out horizontally. And I filmed myself because I was just thought, you're out of control now. It was one of the most wonderful, astonishing feelings of something that you care about so much, doing something so special in a special place. And yesterday when I was reflecting on this on Twitter, to mention that thing again, the number of parade pissers who just wanted to say, well, you should have saved those tears for the final. No, pal. I'll support the club exactly as I want to. And I'm not in your jurisdiction or your bailiwick. I didn't say that. I just blocked them. It was amazing.
Free speech champion, Danny.
Absolutely, you got that right, my friend.
You are right though. Like everything that's happened since, or more or less everything that's happened since, really bolsters the idea that like it was completely worth getting entirely emotional about that semi-final, even though they lost the final.
100%, James.
Close to your heart. Surely, like everything that's happened since, only kind of hammers home the feeling that there is a possibility that might be as good as it gets.
That is the background against which the next brilliant thing that happens for Spurs fans will be all the more extraordinary because of that, which may be some consolation to Michael Debenham, who asks this question. Why are you still bothering? That's us. Why am I still bothering? Why are we all still bothering?
Because one day there's going to be another night in Amsterdam, right? There will be another. Like, you could never have predicted even 2 weeks before it happened that would have happened. And one day there will be another thing like that that we'll be talking about in 5, 10, 15, 20 years' time. Like, you just don't know when it's going to be. It could be next season for all we know. We know it's not going to be in the next couple of weeks. But Spurs get to the Europa League final next season and they're in Bilbao. Like, that could be like the biggest thing for like a generation.
Wonderful.
Spurs, right? It's, who knows? We don't know what's going to happen.
Michael, you know, I don't know where you are in your own personal life, but that is too bleak an outlook. Why are we still bothering? I get it. I know people think there's a kind of Groundhog Day to some of this. And I was talking to somebody who supports Tottenham home and away yesterday, who was clutching, it was him, clutching his head and saying, I know what's going to happen in the summer. They got a half-back Postecoglou. Then it won't start well. And I said, stop. We don't know any of this. You know, things, Michael, things can get better. And hopefully, something marvellous will happen, and you've got to try and cling on to that, my friend.
How many football teams are there in the world with better long-term prospects than Tottenham based on like objective known factors?
Dulwich Hamlet?
I'd say hardly any, really, given that Tottenham are in the Premier League, which is the best league to be in. They've got a stadium which allows them to make money, which allows them to comply with the PSR rules. They've got a youngish squad. They have stability in the boardroom, which a lot of teams don't. I'm not even going to predict that they're going to win a trophy, because as soon as you do that, you're setting yourself up to fail. But I'm not a doomer about Tottenham's medium to long term prospects at all. And I think that there's a lot of other teams. We could name literally hundreds of other football clubs from around the world who would kill to have the medium to long term prospects of Tottenham.
Yeah, I mean, look, as obvious as it is that whatever happened, we're recording this on Thursday afternoon, and Villa have got a massive game today. Like, whatever happens in that game tonight, the second leg of their semi final in the Conference League, Villa have had a better season than Spurs now, for my money. But you know, they're sort of going to be up against it in PSR terms. They're not going to have a whole load of wiggle room. If they're in the Champions League, we'll give them a bit more, and you know, maybe the possibility of them having to sell isn't quite as high. But they're still clearly not going to have loads of room for maneuver in the transfer market in the summer, whereas we think Spurs probably will. I, Newcastle similarly look like they're in pretty good nick again now, but they're not going to be able to spend a whole load of money in the summer by the sound of it. They're going to be quite restricted in what they can do. So Spurs probably are still in a position of some power, rightly or wrongly, and I know people disagree with the way that now works. Yeah, I mean, I don't think things are necessarily so bad, and if, you know, as much as you and I have tugged our forelocks over the last few weeks, Danny, it's probably not.
I ain't got any forelocks, but I know what you mean. Well, yeah, true, I know what you mean. Okay, we have travelled normally through the break, time-wise, and you're into the last section of The View from the Lane with me, Danny Kelly, and James Moore and Jack Pitbrook. Right, last time out on the pod, the subject of time travel was front and centre, and we were talking about building a time machine. Imagine that you could. I mean, it clearly, totally within the bounds of possibility if Einstein is right about things. Change a moment in Spurs' history. I've had some time to think. I'll start with you, James, because you really have had some time to think about this. If you could build a time machine and you could affect Spurs' history, or your own, I'll accept that as well, what would you do?
Yeah, it's tough because I'm trying to work out whether I would prefer Spurs to have won the Premier League in 2017 or the Champions League in 2019.
But what would you change to affect that? It can't. Like, the answer to this can't be like, you can't change things on the pitch.
Well, he can head Robert Huth's header off the line, can't he? At the lane.
Get the game cool up. Can I not give Chelsea players food poisoning or something?
Maybe, yeah. That's pretty,
I mean, I guess what you really could do, if we're going full Back to the Future 2, you would know who the players that would become great players in the future.
Yeah.
And you could go back in time and like speak to Steve Hitchin or whoever and say, these are the players you should sign. Actually, just speak to Daniel Levy. Like, don't need middlemen, do you? Go to Daniel Levy and say, listen, this kid in... where's Messi from?
Rosario.
Yeah. Rosario, thank you. Yeah, go this kid from Rosario. You know, it needs the growth hormones, but once he's had him, he'll be decent. And then he'd ignore you and he wouldn't sign, but he would regret it later and then he'd listen to you next time.
Jack, have you thought about this question at all?
I mean, like, initially, my answer was going to be, I'd go back to 2017, and this is assuming that I could control, it's not like simply having a time machine, it's time machine plus the ability to influence decisions made by other people. So I'd build my time machine and I would go to Tottenham and I would say, I would basically back Pochettino in selling all those, selling Pochettino's best players so they could then reinvest and stay good. You know, like, obvious one being Danny Rose, sell him to Chelsea at the end of the summer 2017 window, pocket an extra 50 million quid, reinvest it in the squad. The problem with that is that obviously, if Tottenham had sold Rose, Lucas, Dyer, whoever else, Toby, obviously, they wouldn't have had Ajax. Like, as soon as you do that, obviously you lose out on Ajax.
You're messing with a space-time continuum aren't you?
So I've been thinking over the last, since we had that Ajax chat, I've been thinking, would the improved chances of Pochettino Spurs over the end of the 2010s and start of the 2020s, because obviously they wouldn't have needed to sack him if they backed him, would they produce anything so good that it would be better than Ajax? It would be worth wiping Ajax from the historical record? I think actually the answer to that question is probably no. I think even if Spurs had been better in general in the 18-19 season and even the 19-20 season, I just don't think it would have been as good as winning a Champions League semi-final with a 95th last kick winner. So I think in hindsight, I think the Ajax conversation has made me think I wouldn't change anything before Ajax. After Ajax, I don't know. I mean, in hindsight, I wouldn't have appointed Mourinho or Conte, but I can kind of see why they did it at the time. But I feel like we're just having the same conversation we always do now.
Jack's built his time machine just to repeat a podcast we've had repeatedly for the last 3 years.
Yeah, well, I thought about it. First of all, it's a personal one. It does connect with Spurs. My mum, I'm the oldest. My mum and I have a fine, really good relationship, but she likes to battle with me about stuff, always has done. But I've only ever once seen her incandescent with rage with me. For some reason, in the early 80s, I needed my birth certificate. So she was really reluctant to give it to me because she knew I was a foul fiend and a flibbity gibbet. And I said, I need that. Just give it to me. Don't be giving me. I went to Crystal Palace for a Spurs Palace game. It was the season that Spurs had the half braces. I can't remember what year it was. The yellow kit had a blue brace that went only halfway down the front. Came out of the ground. I'd lost the birth certificate in the ground, jumping about. I told her this. She went fucking crazy. I don't know why a handwritten document of the day that you gave birth to your firstborn should be so close to her heart, but it obviously was. I would go back to Crystal Palace and find my birth certificate for her. She's still alive. She'd like it, I guess. Funny enough, Jack, I then started to think I would just go back to games and I wouldn't change them. I'd love to be back on the North Bank at Highbury in that semi-final in 81, was it? Yep. When Ricardo Villa got the third goal, we knew we were going to the cup final. It was at Arsenal's ground. I knew I could walk home via 15 pubs that I knew intimately. That joy. The 84 UEFA Cup final victory, when I felt the older of the two stands at the side of the pitch is moving under my feet with the excitement of people. But in the end, oddly enough, Jack, I went to exactly the same place as you. And that was in those two transfer windows, we didn't buy anybody or bring anybody in. And the problem there was me. I was part of the problem because I used to go through that Spurs 11. I loved it so much. I couldn't see how we'd get better blokes or better footballers in for any position. And so I totally accepted that even if they got stale together, that would be all right with me because they were great blokes and a pretty decent football team. In fact, I would say they were a great football team at times. 2017, they were a great football team. And I guess I was part of the problem there. So what I would do now with my time machine is go back and confront my younger self, like Stewie, in Family Guy, and just try and talk myself some sense into myself, into not being so accepting of what I now realise may have been a difference of opinion between the manager and the board that has led to, I think, an overall decline with all the caveats that you said, Jack, about a brighter future in what the Spurs team is capable of right now in the world. And I guess that's it for today, except let's talk about the Burnley game. Spurs, I want them to win it. It'll probably guarantee fifth place if they do win it. Burnley have still got something to play for, James, which I did not expect at this stage of the season. I thought they were gone at Christmas. I thought they were the exact exemplar of everything. Luton were making a fist of it. Sheffield United at least were honest. Burnley were kind of blundering around with their fingers in their ears going, la, 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 this is what we do. But they're actually still in with a chance, aren't they? So
were Burnley less honest than Sheffield United? Burnley surely have stayed true to their style of playing for the most part this season, and for good and for bad, mostly bad. And although it's probably almost certainly going to cost them relegation this season, or the cost of it will be relegation, I have to say, this season, maybe next season and the season after, things will be different. Who knows? Yeah, I mean, I was kind of wondering whether... I think there was a possibility Forest were going to get points back on Tuesday, and obviously that didn't happen.
That didn't happen, no.
Their appeal was unsuccessful, which would have meant that Burnley would be relegated on like a Tuesday afternoon by a decision in an office, which would have been pretty dismal, really. Yeah, I mean, I'm tempted to say Spurs have to win, but I mean... but not for kind of points and... For self-esteem rather than kind of sporting.
For my sanity, right? Yeah.
Yeah, it just kind of feels like they need 6 points from the Burnley and Sheffield United game, and definitely 0 points in the Manchester City game, just to kind of end the season
on a high
with that triple pronged high.
Burnley have got, what equipment have they got to hurt Spurs, Jack?
On the basis of their last game, not a lot.
I don't think I've seen Burnley. I'm not certainly not been to a Burnley game this season. I don't really feel like I've watched them on TV.
They have kind of been sort of inoffensive in there.
Yeah.
They're not the kind of the Burnley of old, are they? I mean, I say this, and they'll probably score 4 set pieces on Saturday. But they're not, you know.
No, they're
not like kind of Sean Dyche era.
They're the exact opposite. They are the playing out from the back kings. And if Spurs press well, they will make chances without having to do, you know, creative progressing of the ball. Let's be honest. Whatever you're hoping for from the end of this season, if Spurs can't beat Burnley at home, and they don't deserve it, whatever it is you're aiming for. We'll be previewing that game, of course, against Manchester City, and where I suspect we'll have a disagreement about that as well, James. But listen, thank you both very much. And remind you, as always, the show, you can go and follow Bits and Pieces on Twitter and X at VFTL Podcast. And more, just as importantly, rather, you can email us at vftl@theathletic.com so we can get your views on things and questions you may want answered if we have space on podcast. And we'll be back again after the weekend, where hopefully the first part of James's triple crown of season-ending glory will have happened for us in London. Thanks again for listening. God bless you all. Come on, you Spurs.
The Athletic.